This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, signature support from the Office of the Mayor President of East Baton Rouge Parish, and the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is your number. Robin Dow and Renee Martin are producing, and your email address is talk@talklouisiana.org. A special treat. We start with one of the most decorated sports writers of all time, Rick Tellender. For many years, those of us who subscribed to Sports Illustrated, and I started doing it when I was 12 years old and had every copy for many years, from 12 to about 30. He is a man who's written prolifically about sports and other matters, and we will talk with him about his career, and it is an amazing one. Named Illinois Sports Writer of the Year 8 times, by the way, and a senior columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. But his latest work is a departure from sports, Sweet Dreams. And it's good to see you, Rick Tellender. Thanks for coming this way, courtesy of our friend Jeff Marks. And you are a man who has what Howard Cosell would call, you don't have dugout vision. He used to say that a lot of sports writers, they only want to call balls and strikes, and they really don't want to find out what's happening in the world. And this book is evident of your interest that goes beyond the dugout.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Jim. It's great to be here. And yes, when I went to college, I went to Northwestern, and I was an English literature major, and a good part of that was studying poetry and, you know, even writing some poetry my senior year, particularly when I had all my requirements done. So I didn't set out to be a poet, and I'm not comparing myself to, Byron and Keats and, the great poet Robert Frost, one of my heroes, Emily Dickinson. But I was really sick 30 years ago. Now it's 31 years. Really sick. And I had a stomach issue. Nobody could figure out what it was. I was in the hospital for 2.5 weeks. And I didn't eat that whole time. I had all these tubes in me and stuff. And I was so nauseated that I couldn't watch TV. I couldn't read a book. It's really an odd thing where nausea is just the main thing. They'd gotten rid of the pain, but I couldn't stand the smell of things. I was really just locked up in my brain, and so I started to pass the time because it was so miserable writing poems. And it was winter time, so I wrote a poem about winter, about snow falling, and then I started to make them. I thought about kids who would be in the same position I was in. Mm-hmm. I was an adult. You can handle things because you've lived a while, but a child being in the same position would be just horrible. And it happens. And for a parent, it's the most miserable thing that can happen. You can't help your kid. You can't do anything. You would trade places with them if you could. So in the back of my mind, I had the Ronald McDonald Houses and the work that they do all around. There's now 387 Ronald McDonald Houses around the world. And says Ronald McDonald, it's McDonald's, whatever, but it's a charity that's separate from buying a Big Mac. But what they do is they have these beautiful places near children's hospitals, try to be as close as possible, where the parents and family of the sick child, who's usually in for surgery, will be in the hospital for a while. They have a place for them to stay, free of charge. There's no charge at all, because you can go bankrupt trying to stay with your child if you're coming mm-hmm. from a distance. And I knew that when the kids come in, the families come in, then they leave. I thought, I want to write a book that would be the kind of thing they can all take with them. And that's kind of what's happened. Got them into the donors, the 5 Ronald McDonald Houses in Chicago, the one in Peoria, Illinois, the one in Springfield, 3 in St. Louis, the National Institute of Health, Children's Hospital in Bethesda, I believe, and now we were just, Jeff Marks, my good buddy who helped with all this, can't thank him enough. We were at the brand new Ronald McDonald House in New Orleans, which is beautiful. And so the kids get this book, and there's 42 poems.
With 42 illustrations
42
that are magnificent.
Beautiful book. Artists. I got to say, it's just gorgeous. 42 different artists from 4 different countries, and I found each one of these artists. I would call them on the phone. Somehow I'd mm-hmm. eventually get a hold of them, even called a guy. Somehow I found his phone number, a little town 80 miles west of London, England, because I liked what his paintings I'd seen online. He was one of the last ones I got. So the 42 different artists each bring a different style to each one of the poems. And I think they take up a full page, as you can see right there. That was it. Each painting's going to be on one page, the poem on the other. And, you know, it's just kind of, yeah, it was a work of, you know, passion, I suppose. And it took a long time because mm-hmm. there were other things going on, you know. And here it is.
It is a magnificent work and something that at your stage of your career, I bet you never thought you would go this route.
No. No, absolutely not. I'm glad I was able to. You know, you look at this, the colors, I'm kind of proud too. I did the cover.
Yeah.
That's my Luna Moth there. Okay. And there's a Luna Moth on the back.
Yeah,
you know,
that's great.
And it's the moon, it's flying. You know, Luna means lunar.
Well,
moon.
I'm going to read a few passages from The City Game. Some of these are about things that Rick has written about in other ways. Since we're in Tiger Town, if you could get ready, you can do the Tiger and Lamb.
Okay, sure.
But The City Game, to show you how Rick has a way with words. So sweet the beat of basketballs when I must go lie down. I hear it when I wake again, the cheery rubber sound. My friends are there along the court. They watch the big men play. Grandma says I need my rest, and I will all through the day. Wacka wacka in the sun. Wacka wacka, never done. Wacka wacka wacka. That's from The City Game with a marvelous illustration. And then there is The Tiger and Lamb. Rick, you want to take that one?
Yeah, it's page what?
45, I believe, 45, is where we are on this one, with a beautiful illustration of a tiger who resembles Mike in all his glory.
Don't all great tigers resemble Mike?
Yeah.
This actually is a, again, from my study of poetry, this is a takeoff from William Blake, who was a 19th century poet, and he has a couple famous poems, one called The Tiger, and it's it starts a tiger, tiger burning bright in the forest of the night. And it basically says, what fearful symmetry, what God could make you with these teeth and all this stuff, this terrifying thing, what peaceful God mm-hmm. could make you. Then he wrote a poem called The Lamb. And it's a very sweet one about a lamb. And he's, again, asking the question, how could a God make a tiger and a lamb? What, you know, what is the world all about? So I thought, you know what? I'm going to have them together. And so this painting, which you can call it Mike, it's a great painting, a watercolor by a terrific artist named Jeffrey Smith, who's done the covers of The New Yorker and many magazines and things like that. You'll recognize his style. And the tiger, Mike, if we will, I've seen Mike in his cage. Mike is lying there, this beautiful Bengal tiger, and he's got a little lamb nestled in his arms by a waterside, and it's reflected. It's almost like the Serengeti Plains. Tiger and lamb. I am the tiger burning bright who holds the lamb with all his might. So fierce and strong, you see my jaws. I scorch the earth. I laugh at laws. But little lamb, I hug in glee as God above, he cradles me. And this is not a religious book in any way, but again, the reference to William Blake, that people who, you know, I like that because... Yeah, they're just pals.
This is a man for all seasons, Rick Tellender. And I got an email, you're in Louisiana. A guy said, I didn't know this guy went to Northwestern in Natchitoches.
You know, it's silly. The school Northwestern up in Evanston, Illinois, is named for the Northwest Territory, apparently. It's the dumbest name because there's a Northeastern in Boston.
Right.
There's Northwest.
Northwestern.
Yeah.
Which has produced many journalists, actors.
Well, including this guy, journalist right here, Jeff Marks, right. Who won the Pulitzer Prize.
One of the great.
He's my driver now, by the way.
Well, you got a good one. But I mentioned Howard Cosell, and he despised ex-jocks who became sports writers and sportscasters, mostly sportscasters. He even wrote a book called I Never Played the Game. But you played the game. And you obviously have a brain. Is that unfair? Because as much as Cosell lamented it, there was a pretty good tandem team with him and Meredith and Frank Gifford, both of whom did play the game.
Yes.
But is that unfair, the dumb jock myth?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Wizard White won the Heisman, and he was on the Supreme Court. I mean, they're dumb jocks, but there's also dumb sportscasters. You know, I don't think either one negates the other one. You can be a dumb doctor. You can be a dumb anything, or you can be a smart one. And Jeff and I just met yesterday with John Ed Bradley from LSU. And that guy was all second team. He makes a big deal because he's behind Dwight Stevenson, center, all SEC center. And he's brilliant. You know, I mean, his writing is brilliant. And no, that Howard, come on. Come on, Howard. Put your toupee back on a little better.
he rankled a lot of sports writers because he was not in their camp, and they weren't in his camp either. But he was brilliant in his way. And the guy who I interviewed many times, one of your colleagues, who I know you knew well, Frank DeFord, he loved Howard. He thought he was the bomb.
Howard was to me, a walking cliche. It was like he's parroting himself. Everybody loves to do
that. Okay, hold that thought. Okay. We'll be back with Rick Tellender after this. This is Jim Inkster, and we're with Rick Tellender. For many years, sports writer for Sports Illustrated. He covered all sports, but he played ball at Northwestern, drafted by the Kansas City Chiefs in 1971. Hank Stram was the coach who ended up living his final years in Louisiana. Yeah. He didn't do well with the Saints, but he loved New Orleans. And as the aforementioned Howard Cosell would say, the rotund Hank Stram. But you thought Howard was a parody.
Well, yes, I'm sorry. I was talking right through the exit there. But it seemed to me that at some point he became Howard Cosell acting like Howard Cosell. The voice was just so recognizable no matter what. And I remember I was at a lobby bar at a hotel in New York, and he came in. And within 2 seconds, everybody in the bar knew he was there because his voice, I'll have a, oh, I can't do it. I'm not even going to try.
That was pretty good, actually.
Well, I don't know who I'm sounding like.
The guy's been dead 29 years, and we're still talking about him. And once there was a poll of the most popular and least popular sports writers or sports casters in America, and he was first in both. So
imagine that.
He was kind of like our former president. He was in everybody's head.
That's right.
And a lot of people loved him, and some people really didn't love him. And Rick Tellender was one of those who I think you viewed things from a different perspective. And Howard... he was bombastic, to say the least. But native of Peoria, Illinois, and you go to school in Chicago or near Chicago, did you know it was going to turn out this way?
No idea. I didn't know I was going to play college football. I was always a skinny guy. And
You were a good quarterback in high school.
Well, it all started with my high school coach. He changed my life in a way that, you know, so much in life is an accident, and then you just hope you can grow from that accident. I was a wide receiver my junior year in high school, and I was pretty, you know, I was tall, pretty tall, 6'1", a little over, and skinny, very skinny. And I always try to gain weight, and I just couldn't do it. And before my senior season, the coach, Tom Peeler, came to me and said, Rick, I want you to be our quarterback next year. Or for your senior year, our quarterback had graduated. He went to Air Force Academy, and I'm like, I really? You know, I hadn't played it. I played it in grade school when we were playing. I think we played flag football. Yeah. And he said, no, he could tell I was kind of shocked. He said, I will turn you into a quarterback. I'll help you. I'll teach you. I'll show you what to do. And he did, starting with how to take the snap, how to lap the ball, how to spin this way, how to hold the ball out that way for a fake. All these things before we even got into passing the ball. We were pretty much a running team, so he made me into the quarterback from nothing. And I said, but there are other guys who were second, third string quarterbacks. He said, yeah, but I don't like them. He thought that I would be a better leader, I guess. And, I had my quirks and stuff. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he did it. And because I became a quarterback, we had a good team. And I was all-conference quarterback. Because of that, I got a scholarship to Northwestern in the Big Ten. But I knew I wasn't going to play quarterback. And so I became a wide receiver and then a defensive back when a new coach came in. He said, you're moving from – we got an opening at cornerback. And I'm like, really? So that was an accident too. And then but you got to go with the accidents and say, okay, it happened. I can't keep trying to understand why, make the best of it. And then I always wanted to be a writer, always. I didn't take journalism. I didn't know how to type. That's when you needed to know how to type.
Of course.
The first stories I wrote for Sports Illustrated, I wrote in longhand. And then or printed, and somebody would type them up. And so each thing just snowballed from there, kind of. And, it was luck. A lot of it was luck.
Well, you mentioned John Ed Brantley, and he did some great features for Sports Illustrated and for other magazines. I remember one he did on Dennis Quaid for Esquire, which was a cover story. And that's kind of a lost art. And he and I were talking the other day, and I mentioned that John Robinson, the legendary USC coach of the Rams for 9 years,
yep.
I heard he's living here in Baton Rouge. Now, that's just an amazing story to me that this guy who spent most of his career in Los Angeles he's 89 years old and living in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. That's a story that begs for Rick Tellender or somebody like you or Jeffrey Marks to write.
Is he not a native of Louisiana?
No, not at all. Coach O hired him, Orgeron hired him as an analyst, and he stayed, so he's been here apparently for 5 years, and I'd love to get him on this show if I can find him, but I hear he hangs out at the Blue Bonnet Library here in town.
Really?
But isn't that a story?
It is a great story, but you know, L.A. and people talk about New York, L.A., all this stuff. You can get tired of that, and Louisiana can seem quite like a comfortable place to be.
Well,
people, you know,
it is an amazing place, but Los Angeles is too, and the weather, of course, when you're my age, and I'm a generation behind John Robinson, and I'm an old man. Imagine at 89 and being in a summer with 20, 30 straight days of 120 degree heat index.
Well, it keeps your joints loose.
That's true. That's true. But is feature writing a lost art?
Well, the platforms for it are disappearing, and there's still great feature writers. There's terrific ones, but Sports Illustrated is a shadow of what it used to be. ESPN, the magazine, is gone. Inside Sport is gone. Sport Magazine is gone. Talking about the magazine pieces in sports, and even magazines like Esquire are not quite there the way they were. There aren't many at all. The New Yorker is one of, and the Atlantic are two of the last ones. But by the same token, you can write what's now called long form. We used to call it a magazine piece. You can put it online. You know, and theoretically, because of the internet, every human has access to everybody else in the whole world. Everybody in China, Russia, theoretically, you can put something out there and it can go viral and they can see it there. So I guess in that regard, there's still a market for it. But if there's not a market for magazine writing or those kind of takeouts, then why would you do one? Who's going to pay you to do it? That's the problem.
What do you make of what's going on in college athletics right now?
It's a wild west. It is crazy. And just today we found out I was talking with Jeff, a quarterback at Miami who was promised $7 million there. And then he claims he was promised $14 million at the University of Florida. This is coming out of
college,
high school.
College, yeah.
College. And he's suing the coach at Florida, Napier, I believe, for breach of contract or something. So this should have been perceived. This was going to happen. The NCAA kept saying, nope, they're amateurs. They get their education. That's what they get. They don't get anything else. And meanwhile, we got coaches making $10 million a year, athletic directors making a couple million, strength coaches making $1 million, but no, can't pay the players. And it had to give, and the courts made it give, because they didn't have rules or hadn't come up with some orderly way to distribute the wealth. The name, image, and likeness belongs to the player. The court said that. I think some of these things might have made it to the Supreme Court, restraint of trade. So you can't stop these kids, even if they're 17, 18, 19, from making money off of who they are. And that's the problem.
Well, we're going to talk about this in a few minutes with Katie Charleston, a lawyer who follows collegiate athletics.
There
but
you go.
A listener asks, and obviously aware of your careers, about steroids in baseball, which you wrote about. Should Barry Bonds or Pete Rose be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, clearly their number.
Rose's course is not steroids; it's other problems. But
gambling,
anyway.
The way I've said this, for me, I don't want to vote for them. And I've seen Pete Rose a couple of times. Talk to him. You can always talk to him at Cooperstown, and he'll be there signing balls, and you can talk to him about gambling. And he said to me one time, "You think I'm the only guy?" And 120 years of baseball gambled, you know, and obviously not. And Barry Bonds was just a guy who was a Hall of Famer before he allegedly started the steroid route. He got very upset about Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa hitting 60 home runs and getting all the numbers. So he said, "The hell with that," and he just like.
He blossomed.
There's a guy in St. Louis when they play the Cardinals, and he'd come out with a helmet that was like 3 feet by 3 feet because everybody said that Barry took human growth hormone and his head grew. So I'm not going to vote for those guys. I vote for the Hall of Fame, baseball anyway, but the next generation can. That's the way I look at it.
What about the Astros guys who cheated a few years ago? Right now, Altuve would be a Hall of Famer, I think.
That's true. One of the things, and the voters, if you vote for the Hall of Fame, which I do, is character and morals. And I hate to be a judge of that.
We are going to wrap it up with Rick Tellender and get some more observations about Sweet Dreams when we return, and then Katie Charleston. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow and Renee Martin are producing, and a few more minutes with Rick Tellender, and then we go to Katie Charleston, who is an attorney with distinct knowledge about what's happening in collegiate athletics, and it's become a money, money, money situation, as we know. And Rick Tellender just spoke of that, but he started by telling us about Sweet Dreams, and today he is with Jeffrey Marks, the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer who lives here in Baton Rouge, and they will be headed where, Jeffrey?
After this, we'll be headed over to Children's Hospital. Children's Hospital in Baton Rouge at Our Lady of the Lake. And Rick is going to be visiting with children over there, reading some poetry from his book, Sweet Dreams, and also donating quite a large chunk of copies of the book. And very happy that he's able to do that in celebration of the incredible work that Dr. Nick Rauber here in Baton Rouge. A lot of people know Dr. Rauber, a dentist, a very good one. And Nick is the man who started the Swolefest Fishing Rodeo in Grand Isle, which has been so successful and so amazing at raising money for Children's Hospital. So in honor and celebration of their great work, Rick decided that would be a neat thing to do over at Children's Hospital.
And Rick, it's an honor and a pleasure. I remember back in the day, I would actually look for bylines in Sports Illustrated. When I saw something by Rick Tellender, I got to read that. Remember Ron Fembright?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. He lived in San Francisco. He's Mr. San Francisco. I love Ron.
He was great, wasn't he?
Oh, he was terrific. And he always wore a coat and tie. Very dapper. Like Frank DeFord, always wore a purple tie. He had this thing about purple.
And Frank was a good man.
Yes, he was.
And a wonderful guest, very gracious. I called him over the course of my career probably 20 times, and he talked to the biggest people around, and he would always say yes.
He was terrific, man. When he started the National back in 1989 or whatever, there was no writer anywhere that didn't want to do that because he was starting it. Didn't work out, but just such a respected man.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you. I hope this is first of many times we talk.
Thank you so much, Rick Tellender.
And thanks for what you're doing. Sweet Dreams is the book. There we go. My mic is back. Katie Charleston is with us, who is a sports entertainment lawyer, a business attorney, former prosecutor, and a legal analyst of note. And she is an authority on what's happening in collegiate athletics. And right now, as Rick Tellender noted, there's actually a lawsuit about breach of contract purportedly by a recruit. Now, Katie, we're in a whole new world right now, aren't we?
We certainly are. Things seem to be shifting daily, if not hourly, in this landscape of college athletics.
Well, where are we going? Do you know?
Well, I mean, it seems like we're looking at a broadening revenue share model for athletes in general when it comes to college sports. There's this major house case that looks like it is going to reach settlement at some point this week. I mean, there's still a lot left to happen, but we're looking at a potential settlement in that case of millions of dollars to be paid both in back wages and also a potential revenue share model for athletes going forward.
Well, could this potentially affect the financial stability of some of these major college powers, if they have to, you talk about back wages, my God, that could be enormous.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about where we are in sports and the major conferences and schools, you really have five major powers out there, power players, and then you've got some other schools that really don't have a significant impact in the area of college sports. And so, you know, looking at shouldering a burden of a settlement, looking back to 2016, we're looking at about $2.8 billion settlement, it's said. And with 60% of that being shouldered by 22, you know, of the schools that are in not really functioning at the levels of, say, Ohio State or Kentucky. And so it really could put them in a bad position financially moving forward.
And it could affect LSU, of course, which is near and dear to a lot of people in our listening area. But this involves schools' rights to promote athletes and to profit directly. How will that change if this is settled as you anticipate?
Well, you know, there's been an evolution of changes since the Supreme Court decided the NCAA versus Alston case. That case focused on antitrust and restrictive covenants as it came to educational benefits like laptops being provided to athletes. But following that decision by the Supreme Court, you know, the NCAA changed its policy around NIL and athletes being able to engage in compensation and contracts themselves. And this potential outcome, you know, the outcome of this settlement will broaden that even further. Currently, there are, you know, state laws across the country that have some influence over players being compensated for NIL. They vary significantly, and that has changed the landscape of even drawing athletes to the various schools. But this settlement, I think, you know, if there is a good clarity, I guess, as to what the players can and can't do, I think it will allow them to better be compensated for their name, image, and likeness. How that will change the amateurism of college sports and the actual feel of it is yet to be unknown. So there's definitely some factors out there that will have to be figured out before we know exactly what the result will be.
We had Skip Bertman, the former LSU baseball coach but athletic director, on the other day, and he left in 2008 as AD. So that's 16 years ago. His budget was $50 million. Now it's $200 million. Where are we headed with this, and when do we reach a threshold which cannot be sustained?
Well, I think we're getting there. You know, the reason I think there is a settlement is because if there isn't a settlement and the NCAA loses in this case in California, they could be looking at treble damages, which is triple whatever the amount is they lose. So we're looking, you know, we're going from 2.8 to potentially, what, you know, $8-9 billion, which could bankrupt the NCAA. But the school budgets themselves, I mean, I think we're going to see some inflation there. Everything's going to go up to be able to afford payments to these athletes.
Well, you note the case Alston versus NCAA, a Supreme Court case in which the NCAA was found to violate antitrust rules and implementing restrictions on benefits. Now, a listener asked, did the NCAA, just out of the goodness of their heart, decide to allow NIL? That's not the way it worked, was it?
No, I think they were definitely influenced by the Supreme Court's decision, and I think that they saw, you know, over the several past years, there's been such development that's put pressure on the NCAA and what they're going to do, and there's definitely some push out there from labor attorneys in the sports arena, like Kessler, to make sure that players are compensated and outside of scholarships, right? I mean, we already are providing benefits to players in the college athletic world through scholarships, but it looks like that's going to be expansive as we move forward.
Well, thank you, Katie Charleston. Any final thoughts?
No, I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Thank you for having me. Happy to discuss it with you.
Well, hopefully we'll talk again soon. Thank you so much.
All right.
Legal
Take care.
Authority, Katie Charleston. And we turn the page, and we're going to be joined in short order by David Matlock, Secretary of the Department of Children and Family Services. He previously served as Chief Judge of the Juvenile Court for Caddo Parish from 1999 until his retirement in 2023, last year in June. And he got a call from Governor Jeffrey Martin Landry, and he is now running one of the major agencies in Louisiana. And we know in the previous administration and in others, there were some real budget issues regarding how children are taken care of, those most in need in our state. And as a result, we have a situation in which David Matlock is fighting to try to do his best with a limited amount of resources to do it. And we're here to get an update from him. He was with us a few months ago, and it is always a pleasure as Judge Matlock comes into the studio, the man from Admiral Byrd High School in the great city of Shreveport. Good to see you again, Judge.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. And every time I hear the Byrd High School name, I think of David Woodley, David Eugene Woodley, quarterback of the Fighting Tigers when I was there. His center was John Ed Bradley, by the way, and roommate. But you and he are of fairly similar vintage.
We are. His brother, Joe, and I are actually good friends, former law partners, and friends from Byrd. Great family, great folks, and obviously an important Byrd is a huge part of the culture. It's city of Byrd, go Jackets! I got to see our mayor was down here yesterday from Shreveport. Got to visit with him for a minute. It was great seeing some other folks too as well.
Well, I mentioned you've got your hands full, and this is Foster Care Awareness Month.
It is,
which is near and dear to you. What's going on?
Well, Jim, we need foster parents. We were talking about summer EBT a couple of days ago, and I was visiting with one of the heroes of standing up that program, Tim Jenkins, and I said, Tim, would you like to be a foster parent? And he said, I was. My wife and I foster children. And I'm like, Tim, you're like a multiple hero now. And I'm telling you, foster parents are so important to our state, to our families, to our children. And the right foster parent supports not only that child and whatever outcome that child needs, providing a forever home if necessary, but also some of our greatest foster parents have helped those biological family members, the mom, get on her feet and be strengthened and equipped to care for their child. And they understand how meaningful that is for that children. And so they're sort of raising a family sometimes. Sometimes they're raising a child, but they are heroes. And if you are at all interested, please call me, email me. My cell number is actually one of the worst kept secrets in Louisiana, but I'm very accessible. Reach out and or talk to any of our offices. And we would love to connect with you. And if there are any hurdles, and there always are, just get a hold of me somehow or another, or my scheduler folks. And I love visiting with foster parents. It's something I do daily.
Judge David Matlock is with us, and we'll talk more about what's going on in his world when we return after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Judge David Matlock, the Secretary of Children and Family Services, took the job on January 8th, and he is in charge of an entity that has 3,700 employees. And really, that sounds like a lot of people, and it is, but in truth, you need more people on the streets, don't you?
We do. Our caseloads are high at the front lines, and we work on that. We need more resources, and we need to spend the resources that we have more effectively. Working smart and working hard are not always the same, and we need to do both. We need to be responsible with the resources we're given, and we have actually there's promising things that we are doing in our budget. There's structural changes that we are making, missional changes that we are doing, and it's an exciting time. It is a true opportunity. And I'm grateful for it. I was just explaining to one of the folks that I visited with you. My grandmother grew up in a mud hut in eastern Oklahoma in a dirt dugout home, and of course no power, no electricity, and I just think the opportunity to sit here in on a radio station that broadcasts, I just wish more people had the opportunity to do what you do, honestly, to do what I do. People work is rewarding and fun and exciting and challenging and hard, and you cry and you smile and laugh, and it's a real opportunity, and I'm grateful to come on to your show, Jim.
Well, anytime a kid is abused, neglected, or abandoned, it's a tragedy.
It is. It's heartbreaking.
And you can't have a 100% batting average on this, but you're trying to get as close to that as you can. And there have been some gaps. And as I stated, this is an inexact process and there are going to be some failures, but what are you doing to make sure there are more successes?
We're trying to reduce caseloads. We have, part of it is a lot of really good changes have been made in the last year. And giving those changes, there's a lag between the effect, the change, and the effect, and letting some of those things come in, come into effect, and then recognizing those successes as they do, some of the changes in processes. I may get credit for some positive changes that are really the result of some folks that have worked hard before and or have developed plans before that we're now getting to implement. And it makes a difference. It's important. Focusing on infrastructure, vehicles, offices, that's a big part of our day is making sure that our offices are safe, wholesome, welcoming structures for not only the public, but for our own greatest capital, which is the people who work for us. Just like our resources, our people are the greatest capital of Louisiana. Well, the greatest capital of DCFS is not our buildings. It's not our policies. It's our people. And it is keeping them trained. We have a relatively inexperienced staff right now. We have hired a number of folks recently and focusing on training and experience and supervision and support of frontline people, not just the absolute frontline, but those immediate supervisors as well. That's where the rubber hits the road, and it's the most important part of what we do.
Well, you got the call from Governor Landry after presumably you'd retired.
I did.
You're a vigorous man. I don't know if you'll ever retire, but why did you accept the call?
You know, if it had been anything other than child welfare, than DCFS, I'm not sure what I would have said. I'm kind of an old school person. When a governor calls, when a president calls, when a so-and-so calls, you know, I suppose if my old high school principal, Buddy Shaw, who actually served down here, you know, there's some people that you respond to, and it, that was a hard, of course, it's something you pray about. You talk to your spouse, your family about, but I couldn't say no to that. I really couldn't.
Well, you, of course,
I'm glad I didn't too.
When you came on this show the first time, this big bombshell of a story came about regarding the food program for summertime. Has that been resolved?
I believe so. I'm excited about it. You know, our legislature has provided us the resources. There have been some kind of unsung heroes, the Jack McFarlands and the Cleo Fields and some of these folks who have worked behind the scenes to make sure that the public voice is heard. They have a job. Legislators have a job to do to respond to their constituents, and they have done that in this instance. And let's just say encouraged us and helped decide what our state, the public wants. Democracy is a powerful thing, Jim. You know that. I mean, you've been around, and we need to respond to those policy decisions that the public makes and that their elected representatives make. They have resourced us. They have encouraged us, and our department. Monica Brown, Allie Rao, our assistant secretary in charge of family services, Rebecca Harris, who's our undersecretary, he manages the finance and structure and logistics and the computer systems and so forth, the cards that go into this. And so as a result of that, we are going to be standing up summer EBT in for all folks who have received all children who are of school age and have received SNAP benefits within the past school year, since mid-August, I guess, of last year, 2023, if they received SNAP benefits for even 1 month from then until now, so to speak, in real time, then the full summer EBT program, which would be $40 a month or $120, is to be automatically placed on their SNAP card by late June of this year, by a date in late June. I'm hesitant to give the exact date because, you know, folks will want to know, but by late June, it's going to automatically show up on their card. They'll look and say, where'd that come from? And it'll be for the entire June, July, August period. if they receive SNAP. So don't get rid of your cards. If you don't have one, be sure and get a replacement. Get online, apply, get a replacement card if it's missing, or if you need it, and that card then will be added if you had those SNAP benefits. Now, pandemic EBT is a completely different thing. Don't rely on that. If you still have that card, that may be usable. Allie, Ms. Rao would need to address that, and there'll be online information mm-hmm. about that. But make sure your address is current. Make sure we have your address, that if we have to send a replacement card, or if we need to send you a new card, or you're just now applying, be sure and give us the correct address. Make sure your address is done on that. If the child applied for a free school program, we will have access to that information. That will come out in a second wave in July. If a child is in foster care, that will be in that second wave. But the foster, make sure you've got the correct right. address on current and so forth. Please make sure you got your card, that your address is current, and that you check our site. The federal program will be standing up an application process, and I think their date is around early July July for having the federal application, and we're like all the other states waiting on that date, and so that'll be an important date for those who don't come in that first wave, so that they'll mm-hmm. be able to get it as quickly as possible.
We live in a state, I think, in which about 1 in 5 or 6 kids are below the poverty level, which is quite low, by the way, the measured poverty level.
In
Baton Rouge, it's 1 out of 4. And when you have your safety needs that are not taken care of, it makes everything else that more difficult, doesn't it?
It does. It does. It's hard to get a job if you're not surviving and not in a sustenance. On the other hand, you get what you reward, and you get what you measure. And helping people escape from poverty, finding off-ramps to poverty, wraparound services, some of the most exciting work that Ms. Rao's division does, Family Support Division, involves case planning and wraparound services for people who receive SNAP or FITAP, what historically might have been referred to as welfare support, having wraparound services. We have a small scale of that we've sort of inherited, but our people wanted, mm-hmm. the people within our organization wanted to expand that greatly. Our governor wants to expand that work as part of workforce development. So making sure that people who are at the lowest level of entry into the workforce have the wraparound services and are able to access transportation, childcare, housing, career planning, all the things that are necessary in order to help an individual get a job. Obviously, a job, as we know from decades, is the most powerful social program you can do. If people are able to work, for those who aren't able to work, it's a completely different matter. But those who are able to work, they want to work. I've talked to too many teenage boys.
I'm with you, but a listener, Zach, asked a good question, that these issues you're talking about now as Secretary of the Department of Children and Family Services, they're the same issues I'm sure you dealt with as a judge.
They are identical. It's the same families, and it's extremely important. It's nice to have that perspective, to have had that voice, to understand some of the times. And when I would talk to a parent and say, what happened? And they would say, well, we got our FEMA check, and we bought methamphetamines, and their child died. You know, literal story. And so you have to be careful about the repercussions, make sure that unintended consequences are managed. But you also have to sustain mm-hmm. people. People have to be able to be equipped. But ultimately, self-sufficiency is the goal. It's the statutory goal in many or most of these programs. It's our goal as a people. It's our legislators' goal across the aisle. They want people to be successful. They want them to emerge and to generationally be successful, have wholesome lives.
Well, appreciate what you're doing. Appreciate you coming by here, and hopefully we'll make this a regular happening. Secretary David.
Always. Matlock. Would you like to be a foster parent, Jim? I'll talk to you after the show. thank you.
God bless you, man. Thank you. And thanks for listening. Back tomorrow. Stay safe and stay tuned.